to the books versus animation kind of role in my life, I had a conversation with my dad a few months ago, maybe, about just kind of how my career was going and stuff, because I never actually planned to get into children's books. It was something that I kind of did to make ends meet when I was freelancing, and it ended up kind of exploding and being really awesome, and I really like it. I wasn't expecting that. So I was talking with my dad about it, and I had said to him, you know, I'd always been so laser focused on doing animation, and I love animation. I told him it was interesting that the children's books became such a detour for my career. And he actually, like, corrected me and said, it's not a detour, it's an extension.
Listening to the Ink and Paint Girls podcast, where we celebrate women working in animation, illustration, and comics. In an effort to share their stories, we not only cover the steps they have taken to get to their dream jobs, but also the struggles. We highlight artists, writers, and producers. We explore the ups and downs of working in the industry and discuss female representation behind the scenes and on the screen. We have a Cutie Mark illustrator on the show. Steph Labiris got her start as an intern who illustrated the cutie marks on My Little Ponies at Hasbro. She found her way from a day job that didn't make her happy. This wasn't the job at Hasbro, though. It was in mobile gaming, but you'll hear all that today. She wasn't happy, you know, and she found her joy in color and drawing animals. She grew into, like, cobbling together a freelance career doing design and children's book illustration, and finally made it into character design for animation, as she always hoped she would. She has designed for Disney Junior, Sesame Workshop, Nick Jr., Simon & Schuster, and that's just to name a few. Wowee, right? Ugh, oh my gosh. So excited to share this episode with you. Please enjoy. We'll just get into it. Thank you so much for coming on the show, Steph.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Of course. I've followed your work for a while, and I just, every time I see bold shape or, like, bold color, or even an animal, it's, you know, it's like, that's Steph Labiris. So it's really cool that your style and your color is just, like, your calling card, you know?
Oh, thank you. Yeah. It's weird because I don't really think about kind of what defines my work. I just kind of do what I like. And now I'm realizing, oh, I made a style. Look at that.
You know? So you didn't, like, start with what's my style when you were, like, first getting going as, like, an artist?
You know, I think I was wondering what's my style, but I tended to kind of draw the things that I liked, and I, you know, everyone's of course drawn to other people's work and other people's styles. Like, we don't design in a vacuum. So I was pulling, like, a lot of influences. Like, when I was in college particularly, I was trying to think about, oh, what am I going to do when I get out? Who am I going to be? You know, what's my look? And I was influenced a lot back then by, like, anime, And actually Craig McCracken's work, like Foster's Home for Imaginary Friends, was really big at that time. And I was super drawn to all the shape work in that and the color work. And that was kind of a huge kickoff for me with kind of how my styles evolved now, I think.
I could totally see that. Yeah, there's all those amazing shapes and color in there too. And, you know, some of your painting, because some of what I've noticed in some of your paintings, I'm being so repetitive, sorry. I'm just trying to, like, form the sentence. There's, like, so much energy. Because one thing I've noticed, like, with my work is, like, when I try to go and, like, ink something or clean it up, like, the charm is lost from the original sketch. And you keep that charm and, like, your lines kind of go haywire, but you still see the character. And I don't even know if, like, what I'm saying makes sense.
No, it does. That's a huge compliment, first of all. Thank you.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny because I always wanted to work in animation. And for a while, I thought I wanted to be a 2D animator. And this was, like, back in high school even. And I knew back then that I had to take a lot of gesture drawing classes, and that movement was really important in my drawings. So I did that. I took, you know, hundreds of hours or thousands of hours of gesture drawing over the years, and I got really used to just kind of exaggerating, kind of pushing movement. But I ran into the same problem too, because I majored in illustration, and some illustrations are very clean and inked very tightly. And I would find that too, like, oh God, you know, I've inked this by hand, and now I've lost, you know, the sense of feeling and the sense of gesture, despite having, you know, a good grasp on gesture drawing. So I found that, with the stuff that I'm doing now, with sort of the painterly stuff and the animal artwork, is that I find that I keep it looser by not actually doing the gesture sketch, which sounds kind of counterproductive, but, basically what I do now is I take, like fairly big brushes in Photoshop and just like throw really big shapes onto the, you know, the canvas. And I sort of use, the eraser to kind of carve out, you know, the silhouette of the characters and the poses, as opposed to kind of sketching and doing, you know, my line work with the crosshatch over the face and kind of, figuring out the volumes, because I think that, the years of gesture drawing have kind of left a mark on me, so that I can kind of integrate that into the shape work. So it's like the lines of action are still all there. I just don't put them on paper, and kind of by not having that there, it sort of frees me up a little bit to kind of push, pull, and like tug on the shapes a bit more, if that makes sense.
Totally. And I could definitely see that, because like you have such great exaggeration in like all of your sketches. So that's cool. That's really cool to hear. I've never really heard it explained like that. It sounds like if you came up against like artist block or something, that'd be a great just practice to do to get out of it. You know?
Definitely. It's super fun. It's almost like working on a scratch board, because it's all kind of like starting with a shape and sort of taking away from it. And I kind of work in a hierarchy. I start with the biggest shape, and then I sort of erase at it and get my silhouette. And then I start to work on the next layer of small details like fur or facial features. And in my work, I don't have a lot of outlines on the characters I do. I tend to kind of only save those for places where there's shapes that are overlapping, like in joints or legs or armpits or whatever, you know, just to kind of show that there's a little bit of volume and overlap, but just kind of letting the shape and the silhouette itself sort of just dictate the whole character.
Mm, very cool. So you're a character designer. We haven't said that yet.
And an illustrator, so, you know, hand in hand.
Yeah. Can you, like, did you, so I think you might have mentioned it already, but did you always know that you wanted to be specifically a character designer, or was there a while where you weren't quite sure?
No, I did not know that. When I was drawing ever since I was a little kid. I'm sure a lot of artists, like, say the same thing, and art was just always kind of part of my life. And I loved cartoons, and I loved video games, and I loved animation, and I grew up in the 80s, so 3D wasn't really a thing back then. So 2D animation was a big influence for me, and when I was 12, I saw The Lion King, and that just, like, flipped a switch in my head, and I'm like, this is it, I'm doing this thing. So kind of from there, I didn't exactly know what role I wanted to have in animation. I kind of defaulted to animator because that just seemed like what people did. And I actually started taking life drawing classes in high school, and I started spending summers out in LA with my mom to visit CalArts, and I just researched the industry, and I was just, you know, really gung-ho about being an animator at Disney. And I think most people kind of starting off on this dream kind of have that exact dream in mind, you know?
Yeah.
So I was really kind of tunnel visioned on that for the longest time. And then I ended up not going to CalArts. I got rejected twice.
Oh man,
it happens, believe me. That was a huge learning experience. But I did get into Rhode Island School of Design. And I decided to major in illustration there instead of animation, because their animation department at the time was not really that industry ready. It was more kind of like for the film festival circuit. But the classes that I did take at RISD in animation, I very quickly realized that I did not like animating. And that's a problem if you want to be an animator. So I kind of went through like a nebulous period in college where I was doing illustration and I liked it. I liked designing and I liked kind of, you know, spending more time on finished pieces, but I always, you know, had an influence of animation. I would do projects that had, you know, animated looking characters in them or stuff like that, but still not really kind of knowing where I was going to fit in. And then my senior year at RISD, we had a character design class for the first time in the school's history. And I had this incredible teacher named Shanth and Jetty. Hi, Shanth, I love you. He taught us the fundamentals of character design. And again, a switch flipped in my head. I was like, oh my God, this is all the things I love about animation, but now I can design for it and somebody else can make them move. And, you know, it felt really right. And it felt like it was at home for me. So kind of from my senior year onward, I sort of set my sights on being a character designer, and, you know, having a background in illustration really kind of helped that.
So when you were in the illustration program, did they like explore all the different avenues in which to use illustration?
Yeah, it was a really broad major, actually. We did everything. We used a lot of different media. I did a lot of oil paintings, so I do have a background in traditional paints, nice. Which I'm noticing a lot of younger artists now do not. And it's digital paint is great, don't get me wrong, but I can tell when someone doesn't quite know how to use paint, like real paint versus mm-hmm. Photoshop, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
But yeah, I did oil painting. There was gouache painting. We did landscape painting. We did tons of figure drawing. Ink and paint, comic book storytelling, because illustration is an enormously broad subject. And one connection that I didn't quite make till later is that sort of unlike fine arts or painting, which was also a major at RISD, illustration is a very narrative kind of discipline. It's about storytelling, whether it's advertising or editorial illustration or comic books, or, you know, just There's usually like a subject and a story to tell. It's very figurative. So I think that was kind of able to keep me afloat and to kind of keep pushing me towards animation, because I was still thinking about story and character and staging and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Is story what draws you to animation?
You know, I think so. I'm not entirely sure what it is that does draw me to animation, to be honest, only that I've had this love for it since I was a kid, and I've never really dissected it too much. I don't know, when I'm designing characters, like, I love reading scripts, and I love, you know, kind of getting a feel of, okay, well, you know, what is this character like? You know, what do they have for breakfast? How do they get dressed in the morning? Like, those kinds of theoretical questions and sort of, you know, starting from scratch and figuring out how they kind of exist in this world, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's cool how, like, you get really detailed in how you're designing characters for animation, but, you know, like, you're just like, I love animation and I love illustration, and then you just do it, you know? I think
exactly.
It's, you really dive into, the character's world, you know?
Yeah, yeah, totally. I think part of it, too, is that I also get bored doing backgrounds. So it's almost like process of elimination and kind of figuring out what you like and what you don't like, you know? Mm-hmm. I know that as a Viz Dev artist, you do want to have a good grip on backgrounds and props and landscapes and stuff like that, but I just find it's so much fun to be drawing something with a face, you know? Like, drawing chairs and interiors and rocks. I mean, there's people I know that are rock stars at that, and they love it, and I envy them so much over what they can do. But for me, I'm like, well, you know, does this chair do anything? Does it like anything? Does it have a soul? You know, it's I need something that's going to be able to emote, you know, which isn't to say that props can't emote. Props are part of a world, you know, mm-hmm. But I just need something that's going to connect, you know?
Totally. You know what brings you joy, and you nail it, so.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, the people who do backgrounds, like, hats off to them, because it's amazing, some of the background designers out there right now.
Oh, I know, so many layout artists, too. I'm just like, oh my God, your patience and your sense of perspective and just your sense of depth and atmosphere and emotion, you know, that they can bring to these paintings. It's just, oof.
Oh, yeah, totally. I think it was only a few years ago, like, after having left college, where I realized that backgrounds could be characters themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, you know, just like a character design tells the story about the character without any words, like, all these props that are in a layout can tell the story about the characters who live in that place, you know?
Exactly. So, exactly how they keep their house, what kind of tools they use, you know, how they decorate or how they don't decorate. You know, there's so much to be said.
Yeah, in a different podcast with people who like to do those things. So, okay, so you've designed for many different things. I mean, you do children's books, you do animation, and you've designed for stop motion, CG, and 2D animation, right?
I have, yes.
So, how does your process change, or does it change between those three different disciplines of animation?
Good question. In some ways, I can get away with murder because I'm typically an early development artist, which means that I usually do the initial rough ideas of characters. I mean, they're usually in color, rough doesn't necessarily mean sketchy, but I'm typically what you would go to in the blue sky phase of a movie or something where it's here's the script, give us five versions of this character and we'll pick one we like. When I say I get away with murder, I mean that I'm typically not the production artist that has to go and worry about the turnarounds or how this is going to be properly rigged or things like that. And I know that if I was in-house at an animation studio, that would absolutely be a concern and I would have to be on the ball about that. But because I kind of get to have the first pass on things, whether I'm designing for a book or for 2D or 3D or even stop motion, I don't encounter those problems as much, just kind of based on where I am sequentially. Although when I did do that stop motion short film, I was working with one of the puppet fabricators, Victoria Rose Most, and she was super awesome. She worked on Coraline. I mean, she nice. Seriously had these chops, and she was so kind to just sit down with me and be like, okay, if you're going to design this character like this, then we can't have the arm here because the animator can't grip that properly. Or the rig, looks like this already, so we have to space this out. So those were some things that I had to keep in mind, but it wasn't as limiting as it could have been, if that makes sense.
Yeah, totally. That must be so nice not having to worry about the pipeline that comes behind you in production.
It is. You know, I keep it in the back of my mind. I do make some small design choices, this will never work as a render, or they'll hate having, this much secondary animation with fur like this. Mm. So I do kind of keep that in mind, but typically it does get passed off to a technical artist or a modeler, for kind of those next steps. So, yeah.
because you've done freelance or you're working on Puppy Dog Pals right now, which is the mm-hmm. same show I work on. So I've gotten to see some of your work come in here and there. And because I'm on storyboard team, I'm not with the design, but so that's why. But, I'm always surprised that when you send your work in, it kind of looks like your finished artwork because you're designing, so you're painting in those block colors, those big bold colors, and you have a gray background, which I think is the surprising thing to me because you don't typically, in the studio see a lot of model sheets come in for designs that have colored backgrounds. So I was really surprised that they're so loose with you to let you do that.
I know, not a lot of studios, TV studios especially, will let me do that. So I'm very grateful to you guys for letting me do that. Again, getting away with murder. I think typically when I think of a TV model sheet, it's this gorgeous, tight penciled, turn sheet with these really tight expressions. And it's stuff that I do want to do. I want to get better at that. You guys at Wild Canary have just been super good about me just giving, finished but still kind of rough stuff, and you just translate it really well. So I'm oh man, thank God you guys have a good team.
Yeah, we get stuff done.
Yes, you
that's
do.
For sure. But yeah, I saw that. I was just wow, that's really, really cool. When people come to hire you, I mean, they're definitely, it's not that, oh, we need to find a character designer. But sometimes people look at your work and they're I want to work with that person because I love this or that. And then when they have an opportunity, they reach out to you. That's what it seems like. I don't know.
For the most part, yeah. I mean, I actually don't get a lot of in-house inquiries for me to come in full-time or anything because I am kind of specialized. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of a choice. I don't enjoy doing tight turns and stuff like that, but I know that I have to. So it's something that I kind of have to go and put the pencil mileage on. But I know that, like, by being sort of specialized and being more illustrative and kind of having my own style that I'm sticking to, it's a double-edged sword, because on the one hand, most of the work that I do is super fun because it's what I naturally like to do. You know, whether it's a children's book or whether it's an animation studio, I'm pretty much doing a consistent style across the boards, and that's great because it's fun and it makes work feel less like work. But on the other hand, if what I'm doing ever goes out of style, and someday it will, you know, it's this nature of the world, then I got to figure out something else, you know? So it's kind of this constant balance that I face of needing to be well-rounded and kind of have a lot of different disciplines and abilities versus being like, nope, this is me, this is what I do, take it or leave it, you know?
Yeah. Man. But, you know, unlike a lot of other people, you have this very special skill on listed on your resume called wool felting, right?
Yes.
So you obviously have way other skills. Do you find that, like, doing, like, crafts influences how you do your artwork?
You know, I think it's the other way around. I think my 2D work influences how I craft.
Interesting.
And I certainly have no illusions about supporting myself on needle felting if things go wrong, so that's not going to be a fallback. But, no, I mean, I think, when did I start needle felting? I started, like, I think 6 years ago, and it was just a hobby. Like, I picked up a kit at the Maker Faire here in San Francisco, and was just like, oh, here's a thing I can try. It is different. And I've, of course, been drawing for years and years, and I just kind of started, you know, winging it and being like, all right, I'm going to make a bird out of this egg shape that I made. And again, it's starting with a very simple shape and just kind of adding smaller details to it, like beady eyes and the beak and, you know, a feather on top of the head. And a character kind of evolves from that. And it went really well, too, because people saw these things, and back then, needle felting was a fairly new craft, so first people would be like, how did you make that? And then they would be, like, really drawn to the character because it was a different way of doing it, you know? So, you know, I really wish I still had time for needle felting. It's an incredibly time-consuming hobby. But, yeah, I think that my 2D stuff probably takes precedent over, like, how I work in 3D.
Hmm. Totally. Wow, that's really cool. That, because, I mean, did it take you a long time to find your process in, like, doing an illustration?
I think so. When I did find it, it happened very quickly, if that makes sense. But I graduated from college, and, like, I was still kind of trying to figure out my style, but I was also, like, very adaptive. I was able to kind of pick up a house style of a studio very quickly, and didn't really have a lot of time for personal work, so I was just kind of, you know, doing what I was supposed to do for work, and I was, you know, pretty happy with that. And then when I moved out here after college, I worked in the gaming industry for 8 years, and things got stagnant really fast. Like, we were just making iPhone apps, and it was just, I mean, not a very involved or creative process. So to kind of get some creative energy out, I started doing my own illustrations in my own time and, like after work. And, my good friend Janine Schaefer and I, both discovered that we enjoy drawing animals in our spare time. And we were like, hey, we should do some illustration books together to kind of keep each other sharp and see how this goes. So we started doing a book series called Snorfles and Meeps that was self-published.
Very
and
cute.
I think it was when I did the very first book, which was like, oh gosh, what year is it? I think it was like 4 or 5 years ago. I remember doing the first illustration. It was an elephant shrew. And I just, you know, sat in front of my computer and was like, all right, this is your thing. This is your project. You do it your way. What is your way? And I just started painting in Photoshop, like, the exact kind of, like, shape-building style that I was talking to you about. And it felt right. Like, I think it was many years kind of leading up to that moment of just kind of musing and observing and that kind of thing. But once I hit it, I was like, all right, this is it. I got it, you know?
Mm-hmm. That's awesome. So when you were working full-time in-house making these games, like, were you making a lot of your own art on the side? Or was the Snorfles and Meeps, like, when it really happened for you?
I wasn't doing a heck of a lot on the side. Like, I would sketch a little bit, and I would sort of compile those sketches into a self-published sketchbook and sell those at conventions, but it wasn't terribly coherent, and I don't think there was kind of a lot of love in what I was doing. Mm-hmm. But when I kind of set some limitations, like, okay, this is a book, it's going to be in color, it's going to be about animals, like, once I kind of had that in place, like, everything else kind of clicked, and I just did what came naturally. And I think also in the interest of time, like, we had a deadline set on when we were going to print these books, and I'm like, all right, I don't have a lot of time to play around, I'm going to do what I know works, because it's going to be faster, and see what happens. And in a way, kind of going back to my happy place and my comfort zone ended up being really productive, because I, you know, enjoyed what I was doing, and it was fairly fast. And, you know, here I am 5 or 6 years later still making animals. But, I mean, I'm not worn out yet, so.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah.
Can you speak into, like, any differences that you have in, like, your mindset when you're illustrating for books and when you're designing for animation?
Yeah, so when I'm illustrating a book, I get to have a lot more ownership over the whole project, because it's just me and an author, basically. And, you know, there's editors and there's art directors and stuff like that that are part of it, too. But basically, I get to have a lot of different roles when I'm illustrating a book. I start with the manuscript, and then I do thumbnails. And guess what thumbnails are? They're just storyboards. So I get to storyboard, which is something that I don't ever get to do when I'm freelancing for animation, because I'm not a story artist like you. And believe me, you don't want me storyboarding a TV show. It will take forever, because I am slow. But I get to, like, storyboard, and then I get to do, like, the layouts, and I get to really kind of play with the story more, because, you know, the manuscript tells me what's going on and who's saying what, but there's kind of little ways you can inject story into it that the author maybe didn't think of. Like, I recently finished this one book called Pretty Kitty, and it was a counting book for little kids about an old man who acquires 10 feral kittens that he really doesn't want. I know it sounds like an animal hoarding thing, but I swear to God it's not. But basically, the gist of the story is that he's this old man, and one by one, every day, an extra kitten shows up on his doorstep, and every day he shoos them away and freaks out about how he doesn't want a cat. And that was kind of the whole thing. And then at the end of the story, he was going to eventually cave in and take in all the cats. And I read it, and I'm like discussing it with a friend of mine. And she's like, you know, what if there's a reason why this old man doesn't want these cats that you can call out in the story? And I'm like, oh, okay. So I added a little element in the story where each day we see, like, a little cat toy in his apartment, or an empty cat bed, you know, that has a cat's name on it. Just little kind of clues that show that he maybe had a cat at one time, but it was a long time ago, and he's kind of grieving over the loss. So I basically made it crystal clear towards the end of the book, where there's, like, a whole spread where he's in his apartment by himself. There's, like, a blizzard outside, and he's just staring at this shrine he's put on his mantle to his old cat. There's, like, photos of him and this cat. There's, like, basically everything short of an urn full of ashes, you know, that just says, this man is, you know, not over it. And that became the turning point in which he decided to take the cats in and kind of move past that. And I had to pitch it to the editor, and I had to pitch it to the publisher, but they totally went for it. So long story short, I like that I get to kind of add those little flourishes and kind of contribute to the story in ways that the text alone would not be able to describe. Versus animation, where when I'm doing character design, it's much more specialized. Like, I read the script. Usually the art director gives me a general description of the height and the age and the, you know, breed or species of the character, if that's the case. And I just tend to be thinking more about the physical attributes. What are they wearing? What color is their fur? Do they wear clothes? Like, how tall, how short, how fat? And it becomes a little more analytical, I think, and sort of more streamlined as compared to when I'm doing a book, which is a much broader vision.
Yeah. I can't wait for this kids book. That sounds amazing. I can't wait to see your details in there. Wow, that's really cool. Have you been to SCBWI?
You know, I haven't. People keep telling me I should. and I should check that out, actually.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. I went once, and, like, it's just amazing, all the people who come and, like, talk about very specific things within the children's book, you know, publishing world. But one thing that I thought of when you were describing, you know, your, you know, children's book illustration process is, like a lot more editors and publishers want, like, books that are less words and more illustration, because mm-hmm. parents don't have a lot of time to read to their kids anymore, which is pretty sad.
Oh, no!
Yeah, but a lot of, I think Dan Santad is one, and, like, where it's, like, the illustration really powers the storytelling. Yeah. And I think it's really cool when it can be balanced between words and illustration, which it sounds like you do which you do wonderfully.
Yeah, you know? Totally. Like, well, thank you. One of the things that I learned in college during my comic book course was, you know, show, don't tell. So that's the same thing when you're doing a children's book. It's like you want to have a balance of, you know, illustrating the text without being too redundant, or, you know, try to have little flourishes. You know, I've learned that kids like, you know, I mean, kids who can't read like to look at the pictures, obviously, and they like to look for little things and details in the background. So I'm like, oh, you know, while I'm kind of working on my background art game, like, maybe that's the thing I could focus on, is kind of working storytelling into that and kind of making it more fun, you know?
Yeah, and that's what makes books timeless, too, is because, like, when they get older, they can read it and get something new out of it, too, through those details.
Totally.
Okay, so we skipped over, like, quite a bit of years between the first time you did Snorful and Meeps. And you said that it just felt right. But what about before that? I'm interested in hearing, if you're comfortable talking about it, when you had your full-time job working in mobile games. Mm-hmm. Like, because, you know, you're in college, you graduate, and you're just so excited to get out into the workforce and make art for a living. And then you get into an art job. Did that happen right away for you?
You know, it did. Basically, my journey into animation has been full of detours, and we all get there different ways, I think. But when I graduated from RISD, I had no idea what I was going to do. I still wanted to do animation, but I didn't know how I was going to get there, because I'm from the East Coast. And, I mean, when I graduated, my mindset was like, I don't want to live in Dad's basement. What am I going to do? Like, it wasn't even about the dream job. It was about not being home. So I was very fortunate, and right out of college, I got an internship at Hasbro, the toy company, who were near the school, and I stayed in Rhode Island for, I think, a year, maybe 6 months, doing an internship with them, working on My Little Pony, and that was pretty awesome, because it was like, I grew up on My Little Pony, like the 80s version, oh, so yeah. Like, it felt like coming home, you know, and I didn't, you know, it was not animation, despite there being an animated series. I had no ties to it, really. But toys are still character-driven. Like, these ponies are characters. And, you know, on their little title cards on the back of the toy boxes, there's little stories about them. So it wasn't a lot of story, like, by any stretch of the imagination. But it was something that still interested me. And I think it was actually the Hasbro job that really taught me about color and shape, because my primary job was to illustrate the cutie marks on the ponies' butts, and I learned Illustrator, the program, doing that, and of course Illustrator is all vectors and shapes, so I learned quickly how to kind of, you know, do a cute illustration with, like, no line work or not a lot of color, so I at least had that going on.
And by the way, that's, like, the best. I'm going to put on the podcast description, cutie mark illustrator for pony butts.
Well, now people know what cutie marks are. I was on Generation 3 of My Little Pony, which was not a very well-received generation. Understood. Yeah. But, yeah, I mean, now cutie mark is quite in the vernacular, which I think is hilarious.
Totally.
I love it. So I eventually ended up getting laid off from there because they had a huge shakeup when I happened to be there. So, you know, just get used to layoffs if you work in entertainment, guys.
Yep, happens.
Oh, God. If you haven't been laid off, you're not doing something right. Yeah. So from there, I went to an animation studio that was in Boston called Soup to Nuts. And that was where we were doing Flash cartoons for PBS and Adult Swim. And that was my first real character design gig in animation. And I did characters for a PBS series called Word Girl. And I did that for, I think, a couple of years. And then a friend of mine in San Francisco was like, hey, come work for Leapfrog. And my rationale was, oh, San Francisco is, like, near Pixar and, like, near L.A., and that's where real animation is, quote-unquote real. So I flew across country when I was 25, and I started working at Leapfrog, and I had a really great team there. As it turns out, most of my old coworkers are in feature animation now. Like, it was a very high caliber of artists there, and I learned a ton of stuff and made lifelong friends, and I was actually really happy there. And that was like the first place where I was inspired to do a sketchbook and self-publish it. So I was actually doing a lot of personal work, and I was, you know, 25 and excited about the world, and it was wonderful. And I got laid off after a year and a half. And it was kind of hard finding work. So because I had worked in games, you know, I found more gaming jobs because that's what I was most qualified for. And that it was a means of survival. And I'm glad that I had the jobs, but just like almost like successively one after another, each job was just less exciting than the last, you know, and this went on for years. And I think, you know, at the worst of it, I just wasn't drawing on my own time. I was depressed. I was debating whether I should move back to the East Coast and just give up, you know, if I wasn't, you know, able to work in animation. I had no direction, really, or kind of any idea how to improve my portfolio. And, you know, feature animation seemed very far away from iPhone games. You know, I just, I was having a lot of trouble and losing direction. But I ended up sticking it out. And
why do you think you stuck it out? Like, did you have like an epiphany, or what was that moment like when you decided to stick it out?
Oh, I wish I could say it was heroic, you know, and that like I had this great epiphany, but it was really, I think part of it was fear of the change of moving back to the East Coast, because there is a finality to it. It's hard to move cross country. And I think I knew that if I did, I might never come back to the West Coast. And I don't know. I mean, I just slogged it out. You know, I was in a relationship with someone out here that, you know, they couldn't move to the East Coast. So like, that was part of the reason why I stayed. And, I kind of got through the slump I did end up getting another gaming job in the middle of the slump that was more fun than my previous ones. And that's when my friend and I started doing the books just on a whim. So I think the combination of finding, you know, a full-time job that didn't, you know, kill me, and kind of having both the excitement and the inspiration and the accountability that comes with collaborating with another artist on something just got me moving again, you know. And I didn't know it at the time. I think it took, you know, a year before I realized, like, hey, I've changed, you know. But it just felt like the thing to do. It's hard to describe.
Do you feel like since, you know, volume one of Snorful and Meeps, that like through your artwork, can you see like a growth in like your uniqueness or point of view or individuality?
I'm not sure. Everything feels like me, so I don't feel like I've kind of reinvented myself or like super evolved across all three books. I think that my draftsmanship's gotten better. I look at some of the first pieces for the first book and I think, oh wow, that looks really stiff, or like, wow, I have two poses on that page and now I can do 14 in the same amount of time, you know? So I think I kind of have that critical eye on it. But I don't feel like I've had any kind of epiphany or breakthrough or like major evolution from it. And I don't know if I'm looking for that. I kind of feel like if it happens, great. And if not, I'm glad I'm still doing what's making me happy, you know?
Mm-hmm. Totally. I the only reason I brought that up is cause like, I don't think I've seen much of your earlier work. Cause like social media really like had a love affair with all your artwork and sharing like more than last few years. But like when I look at your work, I just feel like it's a punch in the face. Like I'm Steph Liveris, you know, it's just like after meeting you, especially at the studio when you visited, I was just like, whoa, she's exactly like her artwork, colorful hair and everything.
Oh, that's hilarious. Oh, my God.
Anyways.
Well, it's funny you mention that, because, like, there is really old stuff on my DeviantArt page, so if people want to go looking for that, you know, I'm not responsible for what you find. But I think most of the stuff that people find online is from the Snorfels and Meeps era, because that's kind of when we were the most productive and we started going viral. So I feel like that makes sense that that's kind of as deep as it goes. But I mean, you know, mercifully, the internet wasn't very prolific when I was in, like, middle school, for example, because God help me if anything from there got online.
Yeah, you know, the internet is amazing and really helps people, like, get ahead, you know, like, there's, you know, kids and, like, senior year of high school and younger who are, like, doing work that, like, people in their, like, 20s are just now getting around to doing.
Oh, I know. It drives me nuts.
I know. It's, like, amazing. But I also feel bad for the high school students who, like, start putting their work up and it's not where they'll be really, like, embarrassed when they're, like, our age. But
oh, yeah.
I also, like, I love that you have your older work on DeviantArt, because it really shows that it takes time to improve, you know, and I'm sure it looks lovely.
Oh, thank
but, you.
You
know, I think that's cool, you know, because people can see that it is a process and an evolution and everything.
Yeah, and I think I've actually been pretty slow, to be honest, in terms of evolution. I don't really get out of my comfort zone that much, I admit. So, you know, with greater risk comes greater reward. So I feel like my stuff kind of looks all the same at this point. But I like how that looks again, so that's fine with me. But I don't know. I mean, when I go back to, like, my DeviantArt account, you know, which I do once in a while, look at the older stuff, I'm all like, man, like, it took me 10 years to go from that to where I am now. Jesus age. Like, I see people doing this in, like, 2 days, you know? Or so it seems.
Yeah, but you have to have time to let life happen, you know? Like, you probably wouldn't have had that huge boom with Snorfel and Meeps if you hadn't been going through this rocky period, you know?
Oh, for sure. And that's a really good point, too, because, like, you know, one of the most unhealthy things I've had to kind of unlearn is that this mentality kind of gets beaten into you as an artist of, like, oh, if you're not drawing every day, you know, you're failing, or, like, draw every day, you know, work. And it's like, of course you should be diligent. Of course you should practice and everything and put in the pencil mileage. But don't berate yourself, because resting is part of working. Like, if you're not living a life, if you're not building relationships, if you're not observing, you know, you're not giving yourself any kind of fuel with which to create, you know? It's incredibly unhealthy to keep constantly working. So I think that I tend to be a little nasty to myself when I'm not, you know, when I decide to have a lazy day, or if things are slow with freelance, you know, and I'm like, oh, I should be looking for more work. And it's like, no, you haven't had a weekend off since June. Like, maybe you should actually sleep today. Like, that's important too, you know?
Mm-hmm. Totally. Like, how do you kind of, are you a person who balances their day out? Cause I mean, with freelance, like, you could probably work 24/7 if you were not careful, you know?
Man, I am, oh gosh, I'm going to out myself. I'm the worst at time management ever. And here I am as a freelancer. I am very much an 11th hour finisher, and I'm kind of coming to grips with that, where, like, especially with the book industry, like, you typically get 6 months to a year to work on a book. And I mean, as you know, in the animation industry, that's unheard of. Like, you know, you get a day at most to work on a character if it's really busy. If not, you get a couple hours. So, I mean, I'm used to a very breakneck schedule because of animation. So with the books, I find that even when I have all this time, rather than spending it kind of musing or playing around with things or pacing myself, I tend to smack it all into the last minute because I need that pressure. You know, I need that for motivation, and it's unhealthy. I'm not going to lie. But it's also just how I work, you know?
Yeah, and I mean, that's good to know. Like, you know what, like, circumstances you are most productive under, you know?
Exactly. And it's hard, too, as a freelancer to kind of set your own schedule. Like, on, you know, when I'm in the heat of a book, I'll typically I'll try to do 8-hour days, emphasis on the word try. I typically just go until I can't go anymore. You know, I don't budget my time off on the weekends like I should. I typically just kind of do marathons and kind of burn out, which again is like part of being an 11th hour finisher because you kind of need that rush, but it's also not really sustainable, you know? So I think I for next year, I really need to work on, you know, scheduling days off and sticking to it and, you know, keeping core hours, as we call it in the gaming industry, you know, setting a 9-to-5 schedule whenever possible and just kind of normalizing things. Because, you know, when you work out of your house like I do, I think there's also a psychological impact because you kind of can't get out of your workspace. Like, I have a studio in my house, you know, a spare bedroom that I work out of, but, you know, if I want to go wander into the living room and chill out for a bit, like, I'm still kind of in my workspace, you know? Mm-hmm. Whereas I found when I was working in studios, like, I could go there, I'd know that I was supposed to work there, and then when I go home, I'm home, you know? So it's definitely more challenging.
Do you see yourself as a business?
I don't. I probably should. No, I mean, I see myself as an artist, which is difficult during tax season. You know, it's a really great question you ask, because, like, I wish in art school they had taught us more about business management, you know, definitely, particularly if you're a freelancer, because, you know, you're your own accountant, your own bookkeeper, you know, your own producer, you know, to an extent when you're working in animation. So I wish I had learned more about the boring stuff like spreadsheets and tax write-offs and all that kind of stuff. And, one thing I can certainly impress upon people who do want to freelance is learn how to delegate and start delegating early. If you don't want to do your own taxes, you go hire yourself an accountant and get that off your shoulders. You know, do everything you can to allow yourself to stay creative without too much stress and distraction, you know?
Yeah, there's a reason why the production side of animation exists. It's to take away those annoying, like, details so that the creatives can just be creative.
Oh yeah, and I have so much more respect for producers now that I've gone solo. I'm like, oh my god, how did they manage this?
I definitely agree with you. I wish that I myself had learned, you know, about the business side of art when I was in school. It would just been a lot more helpful.
Oh, for sure. I had no idea it was going to be like this.
Yeah, but definitely having worked in production and animation, I've learned way more than I thought would be useful in terms of just being, like, ready to, you know, help a team on a deadline, on a, you know, within budget. Because, like, for you saying that it'd be helpful to have, like, a class on, like, freelancing, like, having you as an artist, as a business, especially, it's like these studios can't always afford to hire all the designers or board artists that they could use. That's why freelancers are so great, because you don't have to, unfortunately, give them healthcare and all those things. So I definitely feel like freelancing is, like, it's going to get a lot bigger, I think. More opportunities that way.
That's what I'm noticing, actually, is, like, over the last couple of years, a lot of studios are more willing to work with people off-site. And, I mean, it's great for me as a freelancer, again, because, like, I love animation, and I love that I'm still able to get a fair amount of it, you know, living so far from L.A. But by the same token, like, I find that I'm very extroverted and very much an in-house kind of person. So it's, like, I do want to be back in a studio eventually. I just got to, you know, kind of look for a break in my schedule, rather, for that to happen. But, you know, while this is all going on and I'm figuring it out, I'm so grateful that, like, I'm not only working on TV shows right now, but I worked on a feature for the last year and a half completely off-site.
That's, you know, so cool.
It was nuts. Like, I felt like I won the lottery with that one. I was so grateful, you know?
Yeah. And, I mean, they probably, did they mention that they wanted someone in-house, or was that, like, an exception they made for you?
It was an interesting setup, actually. So this particular studio, it's an independent studio, so they only work with people off-site. The only people they have in-house are editors, some story, directors, producers, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we kept in fantastic, you know, communication. Like, we had, you know, weekly phone calls and, like, daily meetings and stuff, so it felt a lot like I was just part of a team, you know, it was very involved. But in their case, you know, they wanted somebody on the long term who could do it offsite, and that's what I did for like 20 hours a week. You know, on average, I would do stuff for them, then I would switch back to my books and stuff.
Yeah, that had been real nice that it was like 20 hours, so it still like fit into your freelance lifestyle and everything.
Oh yeah, they were so flexible. It was fantastic.
Yeah, especially that, you know, features take a lot longer to make as well, so that's like more of a constant paycheck then too.
Oh, exactly, exactly. I think they're still going to be in production this next year or two, so there might be some more, so yay. But yeah, and that's the other thing too, is like I love working on longer term projects. Like I love seeing something kind of evolve slowly and, you know, kind of seeing where all the changes come into play. And it's nice to be working on like books in tandem with that, because, you know, after I finish a book, like, you know, X number of months later, it's published and it's like, oh, I finished a thing, you know?
Yeah, and then so you can
get that satisfaction.
And then you could tell everyone that you did a thing.
I know. There's
that's
so much
so nice.
I can't tell people. It's like, oh my god, NDAs.
Yeah. You said earlier about, like, you know, you would like to get back into a studio because you really like being around people.
I do.
Do you, has conventions, like, selling your wares at conventions played into that, where you get to connect with people?
Oh yeah, that totally recharges my batteries, like, conventions are very draining and overstimulating, but for someone like me who's like offsite all the time, it's like a family reunion, you know.
Nice.
For sure. And like, you know, it's going to be a balancing act, because I do want to go back to studio work, but I don't want to let go of the books. So I've got to figure out a way where I can still like moonlight doing books, you know, maybe less per year than I have been doing, versus, you know, being in house, you know.
Yeah. I love that word, moonlighting. It's such a romantic word.
I know, right? What it really means is pulling all-nighters, but, like, whatever.
I know, yeah. Yeah, it's less romantic when you define it.
Yeah. You know, kind of relating to the books versus animation kind of role in my life, I had a conversation with my dad a few months ago, maybe, about just kind of how my career was going and stuff, because I never actually planned to get into children's books. It was something that I kind of did to make ends meet when I was freelancing, and it ended up kind of exploding and being really awesome. And I really like it. I wasn't expecting that. So I was talking with my dad about it, and I had said to him, you know, I'd always been so laser focused on doing animation, and I love animation. I told him it was interesting that the children's books became such a detour for my career. And he actually, like, corrected me and said, it's not a detour, it's an extension. And I'm like, oh my god, you're right, they are related.
Ooh,
yeah,
I love that connection.
Really, yeah, and mind you, he's, like, an engineer, so, like, it's kind of weird to hear him make that association. Very analytical kind of guy, but, like, you know, it was a little epiphany, because I was like, yeah, I actually get to do, you know, two things that I really love, and this is wonderful, and I want to keep that balance, you know?
Yeah, and I mean, it's all a part of visual storytelling, too.
Exactly.
Know? Yeah.
Exactly. It's funny, too, because a lot of publishers that I've worked with have said that they enjoy working with people with an animation background because we're so concise and understand storytelling, and I'm like, oh, yeah.
Yeah, I think another part of that is, like, also, especially TV animation, people who've worked in it have to get things done so quickly, turn it around so fast, that I'm sure it really helps them meet their deadlines in the publishing,
for sure.
You know?
For sure, yeah. I mean, I've gotten a lot of, like, very positive feedback from publishers about how quick I am with changes, and I'm like, you know, they'll give me, like, 2 weeks for a change, and I'll just make it in, like, a day, because that's kind of what you do, and they're just like, oh my god, and I'm like, how slow are your artists? What do you illustrators do?
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, I know, right?
Yeah. For, you know, someone who, so at our advice portion of the show, for someone who is maybe between school and getting their first job or like finding their voice, because I feel like you need to find the love for what you're doing before someone will hire you for it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So to this person, what kind of advice would you give them just beginning their journey?
Out of college into the workforce?
Sure, yeah.
Man, I would say first and foremost, don't be too picky. You probably won't get your dream job right out of school. It does happen, but you got to be ready to kind of pay your dues. You know, I worked a lot of jobs. I didn't want to work to make ends meet, but, you know, even in those gaming jobs that were kind of, you know, bland, I made connections with people who went on to work in animation and to do things that I wanted to do, and I'm still in touch with them, and we still help each other. So you kind of never know what kind of connections you'll make. Keep an open mind. Don't be a jerk, you know. Industries are very small, you know, so you don't want to be a gossip. You don't want to badmouth anyone. You want to be courteous and hardworking, and that will, you know, that will reflect well on you, and people remember stuff like that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I know it's impossible to say don't panic if you don't have it all figured out, because it is scary if you don't have it all figured out. Like, I totally get it, but I mean, as best you can, just try to enjoy the journey and keep a good online presence. You know, you guys are so lucky right now where you live in an age where there's so much social media. Like, when I got out of college, I mean, I think Blogspot was just becoming a thing. I mean, there was no Twitter, there was no Instagram, there was no Tumblr, there was no Reddit or all these image sharing and stuff. I mean, you have so many tools for free at your fingertips. Just, you know, be a courteous, productive online presence. Get your work out there. Reach out to people. Ask questions. You know, if there's an artist that you really like and you wonder how they do things, send them an email. Worst case, they can't get back to you. You know, just there's so much going for you in the world right now. Just go out and get it.
Well, I'm energized to go out in the world and get it now. This has been great. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Oh my God, thank you for having me. I hope I didn't ramble too much.
No, it was great. You're amazing. And you talk about your process so in, you know, what's the word? I want to say insightfully, but I don't think that's quite the word, but that I think that's basically what I want to say.
Introspectively?
Yeah, that and precisely, and the word you just said.
Yay, I art good.
I do wonder, like, do you have, like, a driving force or purpose behind your artwork, or do you just make it because you love it?
I think I make it because I love it, but, I mean, that sounds like such a shallow answer. I think I just want to make stuff that makes me happy and makes other people happy. That one thing that I've started doing recently is I've started taking commissions for pet portraits. And I found that I don't ever really take commissions. I won't draw human beings as commissions because, God, it's hard to draw people. but I find that when I draw people's pets, there's such an instant connection over, you know, not just the subject matter, but I mean, you know, they tell me about their pet, what their life was like or is like, you know, what they like to do, because this pet is a character, and there's this mutual, you know, love of animals and connection that I find that it's become kind of a new inspiration for me. And I actually want to start doing more pet commissions, because I find really awesome people doing that. You know, the commissions are fun to do, but I've just found that, you know, kind of by promoting my animal work and the type of people that are drawn to it, you know, I'm connecting with a lot of really great animal lovers, and I want that to keep moving forward.
That's awesome.
Oh, for sure.
You're finding, like, a very niche community there.
It's not as small as you think, though, you know?
I guess that's true, yeah.
Yeah, well, another fun thing, too, is that, like, a lot of times I'll draw really weird animals. Like, I'll draw axolotls, or I drew leopard geckos, or I draw like, a lot of rats, because I've had pet rats for a while. And, you know, when I go to conventions, like, all of these exotic pet owners come out of the woodwork, and they are so relieved. Like, they're delighted, but they're also relieved to see that, like, their animal of choice is getting attention. You know, and I love that. I love that I can be the guy who's like, oh, you know, you drew leopard geckos. That's amazing. Let me show you pictures of mine. You know, it's such a cool connection, you know?
That is awesome.
I love it. I wasn't expecting that.
Yeah. That's cool. You're giving, like, a visual voice to the lesser known animals, I guess.
Exactly. Actually, one of the books that I'm illustrating for next year is about the animal underdogs in the world. So there's, like, naked mole rats and Etruscan pygmy shrews and you know, skunks and you know, sea roaches and just the stuff that people, you know, normally don't connect with. But I'm all over it. I love the underdogs.
Oh, that's so cool. That's really cool. I know that you mentioned that, like, you haven't, like, thought ahead to when, like, if, like, your style goes out of favor, like, in popular culture and whatnot. But I feel like no matter what happens, you still have this love for animals. And it's so specific, you know, that I think you'll evolve when the time is ready.
Oh, thank you. I hope so. I admit I feel bad for not planning ahead, but I'm also like, well, it's working now and I'm happy. So we'll just go with that.
Yeah, just enjoy it. Ride the wave.
Exactly.
Anyways, thank you so much for coming on the show, Steph.
Oh, well, thank you. I really appreciate it.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider leaving a review on iTunes. It helps us reach and share these stories with a wider audience. In sharing these female voices, we strive not only to help pave a path for aspiring women professionals, but to build a community and safe space for female creatives to support and empower one another. Like life, working in these industries is not a destination, but a journey of hopping from project to project. So I think we can all use the support. Want to chat? We're on Twitter at Ink, the letter N, Paint Girls, and on Facebook at Ink and Paint Girls Podcast, or email us at inkandpaintgirlspodcast@gmail.com. The Ink and Paint Girls Podcast is brought to you by me, creator and host Cassie Soliday, and produced by Val Patrone in sunny Burbank, California. Music composed by TV's Kyle. The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are our own and do not represent those of our respective employers. Until next time, this has been the Ink and Paint Girls Podcast. Thanks for tuning in.